Hello, this is Peter Davison. You're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio.
This is Gallifrey Public Radio, a weekly podcast dedicated to positive enjoyment of Doctor Who. We travel through classic and new episodes, explore the extended universe, and play a few games from time to time. We do discuss news, content that has been officially released, and the occasional interesting rumor, but we'll warn you before anything considered spoilers comes up. Welcome to episode 416 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we're just chock full of surprises, aren't we? You know, I guess the song is true. No changes are permanent, but change is. Tom Baker, Tom Sawyer. Maybe there's a connection there. Well, I'm Kier.
I'm Haley.
I'm Jay.
And I'm Julie. This week, season 18 of Classic Doctor Who comes to a close. And while Logopolis brings a convention panel lineup of iconic characters into the TARDIS, it also marks the end of an era. Too soon? Too late? Or just right?
Didn't want to spoil it for anybody when we were leading into this last week, so I just said, we're going to watch Logopolis, and I left it at that. And I wasn't sure if by title it would ring any bells for either Julie or Haley, so let's find out. Haley, were you coming into this in full knowledge, or...
No, I was not. So I had heard the title before as like a big, huge episode that people talk about all the time, but I couldn't remember why. And it's funny because as I was watching this, I was like, man, Baker's been the doctor for a really long time now.
He looks tired, doesn't he? Well, all right. And Julie, I think you had a similar kind of experience in, as far as knowing, didn't Kier wander off to the cinema screening that they did just the other, it feels like just a little while ago, back in 2019. Can you believe it? Way back when, 2019.
So that was 2 months or 20 years ago. I don't know which.
Right. I don't know which. Because each month equals a
simultaneously.
Year.
Simultaneously.
Yeah, I recognize the title as a major shift and change, and then also recognize, since I pulled up the episode, that it was only four left to the end of season, so I kind of knew this was coming.
Okay, and do you feel that it cast any sort of a pall over your viewing, like you were just waiting for the shoe to drop, or was it...
I tried to look at it in a positive light, to watch for the story and not necessarily for the end of an era.
End of an era. True. And Jay, we've probably talked about this before, but how many times would you say you've spun through this particular story?
In its entirety, maybe three or four.
Okay. All right. You still feel like you're getting anything new out of it with subsequent viewings?
Maybe a little bit more now, because I've never gone through... I've never gone through beginning to, or like, you know, kind of how we're doing this rewatch. It's always a drop in. You know, I might watch one or two beforehand, but never in its entirety, kind of like sequentially. So, yeah, I feel like I did gain a lot more out of it this time just because of what's surrounding it, but not necessarily that there was anything new from the episode itself.
Okay, got it. All right, well, we can definitely parse all of those things. So, let's... Let's fall into this one.
Too soon.
Logopolis?
Yes. That Ariel's a recent addition.
Are we going to be staying long?
You are.
What?
You and I have to part company.
Look, if you're going after Nyssa, I'm coming too.
Don't argue.
I demand to see who's ever in charge of this ship!
If you want to consult your calendars, you can note that this, as we are recording and as this is being released into everyone's ear holes, this is the actual weeks and month
40 years ago to the, I guess, day or to the time period that these episodes aired for the first time. So even more timely than Fathom Events doing their cinematic airing with all their extra footage and all that good stuff. So good on us. It's like we planned it or something.
What?
It's like we arranged our entire schedule.
Not everyone is as professional as we are when it comes to planning things.
Yeah, see, you thought all those times we were just taking a bye week was because we had, like, the flu or something? No, no. We were just staggering so Legopolis would fall right at the right time. But it's a big deal. I mean, this is a pretty momentous story for a number of reasons, both in the content and the repercussions, I would say, right? Is that a safe assessment?
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say so.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the first thing we get right out of this is we get to meet Janet Fielding herself, Tegan Jovanka, having a great old day, just trying to get to Heathrow. I need to get everyone's initial reactions to the Tegan spectacle.
I have been there, not closing the door, not knowing what's going on, really. And I feel like she handled it really well.
Gonna be late on her first day at a new job.
Only responsible for the lives of a couple of hundred people on a commercial aircraft and can't even remember to close the front door.
She even went back and did something else, like grabbed her bag and was like, no,
she still forgot the door. That door. Yes.
She even said it out loud, the door. Turned around. Fantastic. And all the while, her auntie, Vanessa, trying to get the car started.
Auntie Nessa.
Auntie Nessa, yes, yes. Well, yes, Vanessa, Auntie Ness, yes. But yeah, I think that was just a great kickoff for the character. And I mean, we're sort of looking at it in the rear view, knowing everything that's to come and all, but I would imagine that...
Not seeing anything for future Tegan, I love her from the beginning.
Great. Yeah. That's exactly... That is the appropriate response.
Don't know anything else about her except that I love her.
Yeah, yeah. And she just gets better. It gets into this really fantastic, like right from the first episode, we get into this fantastic confusion, this compounding issue of which TARDIS is what TARDIS, which one's on the outside, which one wrapped around what, which one is the Masters, which one is the Doctor, to the point where even they don't know. Mm-hmm. So you are already thrown off your game about 9 minutes in to episode one. Which is a testament to, I think, Christopher Bidmead's ability to know what makes a really entertaining use of some of the rules and game pieces that they've been given to work with in the show.
The only thing I did know was that the original TARDIS wasn't the Doctor's TARDIS because of the laugh and because of the way it was sort of mysterious and the door opened and someone disappeared inside.
Right. Right. Usually not the Doctor's MO to grab someone
secretively.
The door laughing maniacally.
Yeah.
Yeah, he laughs jovially when he snatches people off the street.
Right. But not even super maniacal, just like a calm, I know I'm doing the right thing and it's bad.
Right. We have this, I guess it starts as this kind of an issue of, you know, the Doctor sort of, you know, works with Adric. Hey, kudos to Adric on this one, really becoming a contributing...
valuable member of the TARDIS crew.
Yeah, or as they would say on the Island of Sodor, a really useful companion. sorry, that's a Thomas the Tank Engine reference. This is what goes on in my house. this whole idea of it becomes not only a complication with determining... You know, the TARDIS can't dematerialize when inside another and all of that ball of wibbly wobbliness. And then it comes around to this idea of the chameleon circuit repair, right? Or sort of running in the mix of that is this whole pursuit of the chameleon circuit repair, which I think is fantastic because it means that we're taking the return to Earth after a long time away, doing all of these off-planet adventures. And smacking down in one of the few remote countryside places where you might still, in 1981, you might still see an early 60s police box out there. So
specifically, how did you get here? There's only the road.
So there's just, I think some of the timing and the placement of all of these little pieces just is so enjoyable. Jay, as you were saying, in being able to watch this chronologically and hitting all the stories in the lead up, we're at this at full tilt. And I completely agree with you that when we've been watching it, we go back and we like grab a story off the shelf or queue it up on a media server or something and say, you know, it's been a while since I've watched Warrior's Gate or something like that, or, you know, the Planet of the Spiders. When you come into this one, there's the, you might go back and rewatch it for sheer enjoyment factor, but coming into it, knowing all the stories built up, you've seen, you know, we've dealt with all putting all of these little puzzle pieces around the edges, and now we get to finally start to click them all together. And it makes for a really, really enjoying interplay between all this, including things like the Adric factor, or the fact that, you know, Tegan ends up sucked into this thing and handles first step into the TARDIS quite deftly. She gets mad in true Tegan fashion. I want to see the pilot.
Yeah. But I mean, understandably so.
Yeah, yeah.
Do we feel like the first two episodes was a lot of setup, though?
Well, it's a good question. Is it a lot of setup, or is it a matter of this is a, I don't want to jump too far ahead, but is it knowing that they are going to have to bring some new things into the mix and cast other things off? Does it require really cementing a lot of the core components before
So a couple of the things that you've already mentioned were part of season or the second episode.
Right.
So I'm not saying that it's bad. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that it felt like a lot of build up because I feel like the second two, three and four were very heavy and dense, and you needed to establish why and where they're pulling all of these pieces from. But I was just wondering if everyone felt that way.
I probably could have seen a little bit less of them working on the car tire.
True. Yeah, that took a while.
Those things are, when you can't find the wheel spanner, it really slows down the process.
Well, when you're trying to adjust the lug nuts with it all the way off the ground, that's rough.
Anyone who's ever changed a car tire has got to be watching that going, Tegan, put the tire back down and crack the nuts. Just put no, we're gonna be here all day.
That's what got me was when her aunt was like, you should lift it up on a jack, and I'm like, she hasn't broken the nuts yet. No, it's fine. Just let her do her thing.
So but that's to your point on that, Julie, about what is the sweet spot for establishing what even your initial perception of the plot and conflict to be dealt with is going to be, is that have we gotten sort of conditioned to get that all kind of dumped on us in the first episode, or is that really kind of the best pattern for it? And Haley, I'd like to ask you, because I know you tend to be really, really observant too. They could have tightened this up. They could have stretched that moment. That sort of thing is something you're usually really cognizant of, even as you're absorbing a story for the first time. So did you feel like you wanted more of something later in the story that could have forced an abbreviation or vice versa?
Well, I think maybe like if we cut a couple of the car tire repair scenes, that gives us more, we can maybe pull in some of more of what's happening inside the TARDIS a little earlier into the story. Instead of having to try and explain all of that later, we can start seeding some of that information now in parts one and two.
Or even possibly, you know, sending Tegan on one less trip around the TARDIS.
Right. Let's see the corridor from this angle. Let's turn the cameras around and see the corridor from this angle.
Let's put a plant here and send her out the door again.
You do notice. All right. So I will note that we've probably gotten more in the... Well, we didn't really have a whole lot of mention of it previously. The cloister bell got a whole lot of working through this one, right?
Right.
I got some good solid explanation, you know, as far as, you know, layman's terms, trying to break it down as far as it's a warning sign sort of thing. And when things start to go bad in the TARDIS, or when you're deeper into the TARDIS, the bell sounds all distorted because you're in.
But I also love that the cloister bell was somewhat of a oracle chime, because you weren't sure which bad thing it was pointing to. And the doctor says that a couple of times, like, oh, that was the thing outside, kind of, or there's something deeper in. So you don't know what is the chime 4 at every moment.
Right. Do you think that was intentional, trying to add that in as another layer of confusion to the viewer? So I'm going to give you this indicator of something that means warning or distress, and then I'm going to make even that aspect of it a potential misdirect.
Yeah, it just made me stress the whole time.
Good job done. So, but then we end up seeing this mysterious white figure. We get it right from the first episode. We get more and more screen time for this watcher figure as it goes on. Now, Haley, Julie, seeing this through for the first time, right, in its entirety, all four episodes, did you have any sort of suspicions as to what was really going on with that figure, that character?
No.
Any theories as you were going through?
So I've seen people cosplay it, so I knew it was important. I did not know what the end result would be. And I thought that it was very interesting that we as the audience never heard the interaction points. We just saw it from a distance, and that there was always a nod at the end before the two parted. So when the doctor left the watcher, you just saw a nod like, okay. And then same later when Adric leaves the presence of the Watcher, he sort of nods. Same thing, like, yeah. All right.
And wouldn't explain to Nyssa what was said.
Right, even very serious at the end. Like, it is the way it's going to be.
Right.
This is the thing we need to do.
Well, so I'm going to jump a little bit to the end here, because since we're discussing the Watcher, I'm of two minds on this as to whether or not it's a clever use of this half manifestation, sort of astral projection of the future Doctor drifting back to meet himself and see himself through the regeneration process, or whether that is kind of you're pulling hinky science even by your own standards, and the laws that you've put down are what you've established as canon within what Time Lords can and can't do, Blinovich limitation effect, can't meet yourself, and so on and so on. So did it sit okay with everybody, or what, did it feel like a little bit of an odd use of its own rules?
It felt like one of those times where it pushes too close to the edge of supernatural as opposed to hand-wavy science.
Yeah.
But without it, do you feel like the Doctor just sort of, I have this idea, let's go to this place. Does that feel better or worse?
I have to wonder if that weren't there as I told myself to do this. You know, hey, Ted, don't forget to wind your watch. that there could have been other paths for the Doctor to decide, you know what, I know I said we were going to Earth, but we really need to get to Legopolis because...
Well, no, they were going to Legopolis, then they had to go to Earth, then they had to go to Legopolis, then they had to go to Earth, then they had to go...
I don't feel that was overly confusing. Yeah,
I don't hate the mechanic of having the monitor. Is that what they called him?
The Watcher.
The Watcher. Okay, I don't hate the mechanic of having him there, but I just wish it had been explained a little differently.
Okay. Something just at the end to be the kind of the plink. There's your answer all along.
I would have just accepted that as a time being who was making sure everything followed the path it's supposed to follow.
Right.
It didn't even have to be the Doctor making sure he himself follow that.
Could have been another Time Lord.
Yeah.
Time itself. Didn't we have time wraiths in some episode?
Oh, but yeah.
Before after, like yeah, things that say they're sort of watching to say this is the path that must happen, because this is a crux point that if it doesn't happen, then the whole thing sort of doesn't become.
Yeah, that seems like a better explanation.
Yeah, definitely. Like I've never understood the concept of like the Watcher is the Doctor, but not quite yet the Doctor, but they're there. And it's... If that's the case, then why is this the only time that we've ever encountered something like that?
Yeah, it sets a precedent that thankfully I think they haven't returned to the whole idea. Well, only insofar as there have been messages from previous doctors sent ahead to help companions deal with new doctors and that sort of thing. So now leaving yourself a voicemail is much a different sort of thing.
But you show up in person, it makes it more formal, you got to wear the ruff, and it just gets weird.
If you're watching this film, I'm already dead.
Yeah.
But we have to acknowledge the fact that now we finally get a chance to see Tremus. I mean, the Master.
Can we just say that the Master's flying of his TARDIS ability far surpasses the ability of the Doctor to fly his TARDIS?
He can land that thing on a dime.
It has long been established that the Doctor's a bad driver.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He's a stylistic driver. The Master does, as we've established, the Master has adopted Gallifrey Drift.
Yeah.
Because he likes to skid in.
I honestly think if they were ever to classify this, it's that the Master is making fun of the Doctor for having the brake on, and he goes,
pumping the brakes every time.
But also then lands perfectly silently when he wants to and shifts on the, someone walked by and noticed that this is a plant and not a pillar. Broop.
Yeah,
I'm ready now.
So the Doctor is that friend that's convinced they're a great driver, but always almost kills you.
We got here, didn't we?
Yeah.
I know you noted in particular, the first time you get to see him in full on Legopolis as they're walking through the streets and they're passing each opening with a mathematician and they're doing his humming, mumming, 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 mumming. And they come around the corner and the whole cavalcade of them walk right past the Doctor, who is grinning.
They didn't even see me. My outfit is so good.
Absolutely, absolutely love it. It is, it's fantastic. And the level of, while we loved Tremus and we thought he was dashing and wonderful and lovely and benign and all these things, and knowing that that same individual can hand you this twirly little oil slick of an adversary.
Who giggles, but for him it's like this deep chuckle, but you know it's a girly giggle.
Oh, it's a... Yeah. It's absolutely delicious. It's absolutely fantastic. And the fact that we get, this is their first, well, as far as we see, but you sort of get the impression from the nature of the dialogue, this is the first time where they're ever forced in a position where they have to work together. You know, that old trope. But it lasts all of about, what, 94 seconds? They shake hands and go, together? Together. And then they get to the control room. One thing goes wrong, and the Master's like, deuces, I'm out of here. Yeah. Let's leave these creatures all to die for
but
themselves.
But before the Doctor leaves the whatever area they're in, he also turns to Adric and goes, cloister bells, like, get ready.
Battle stations.
Secret, yeah. Yeah, battle stations.
Battle stations.
Secret message, shake hands, go away.
Beedly boop, 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 beedly beep, beep. There's so much in this story. I swear, it's so much fun. It mentioned Christopher Mead taking on a full credited writing role, which is not often, right? We'd seen it in the past where it'd be like Douglas Adams having to write while he was the story editor. He'd give himself a pseudonym because they didn't normally do that sort of thing because it ticked off the writers' unions. What, you can't be story editor and write the stories? You know, we need jobs. They're taking all our jobs. But he stepped in on this one, so you get smacked upside the head with so much scientific gobbledygook.
I have to say I love that the result of the people being shrunk by the Master was the TARDIS being shrunk by the same approximate amount of people who were shrunk to the total. It wasn't all the way to the miniature,
right?
But it was about halfway or two-thirds there, and that's about the mathematicians that got shrunk.
You shrank so, two-thirds of our mathematicians. We're going to screw up two-thirds of your dimensional calculations here.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. But to your point, the fact that there was a lot of math and a lot of numbers that were referenced and included in a lot of the dialogue and reasons why all of this started to fail, I thought that was a very interesting and key point of it.
And anyone who has ever done any programming will appreciate tracking down the one character that has gone wrong.
Oh, Jesus.
Where the F is that semicolon that has thrown this whole thing off? But the fact that, and I'm still, this boggles my mind again to this day, every time I see this, as they're walking through the sweatshop, as Tegan would call it, the mathematical sweatshop, mm-hmm. and you know the monitor is reading off, you know, 6E, and Magic says 6E, no F, you know, or whatever, and they're checking the mm-hmm. whole thing. Is each one of those eggheads only controlling two characters?
One bite.
So inefficient.
But I read that as somewhat doing a little bit of code these days as like the section of code that they would be referencing. And then it's, do these numbers match? Yes. Because he's looking at their little, bits of...
Dude, yeah, that's it.
No, but they have their abacuses, and I have to think that those abacuses control a little bit more than just two characters. So nope. He's checking. He's like, this is this number, 6E, this is his designation, and he controls this abacus, which relates to lines of code.
I'm just waiting for them to walk by, and like, he says, 4F, and he says, no, it's 4D. No! And the monitor just smacks the guy in the back of the head. I said, F, F, F.
No. It's got to be, so like, if you're in modern coding software, mm-hmm. you know how you can carrot down or carrot up and expand?
Collapse that chunk of code, yeah.
So you're expanding that chunk of code, and that's their abacus. So that chunk is that one little, like, carrot up. Okay, we've checked that code. It looks good. Mm. And that's why it's so important that the monitor was reviewing what Adric was doing. Mm. And I feel like that was a good use of their time.
Clearly not debugging too closely. They didn't
trust Adric to get two letters.
That's true, yeah.
But hey, what did he say? The clumsy Earth numbers are hard.
They're not our usual wavy lines and swirly bits.
Watching a young being try to learn Earth numbers and letters can affirm.
Yeah, very true. So we've got things like so they were going through all of the block transfer computations, right? On mm-hmm. figuring out how to, I guess the plan was to put a wrapper around the broken TARDIS that would then allow it to have chameleon circuit functionality. But things go way off the rails as we get into the idea of mathematics breaking down the fabric of reality. You've got the monitor who, blips out in a green screen death and all these wonderful things, and Legopolis collapsing in large styrofoam chunks.
Before that, though, the doctor or the master saying, I meant to do this. This is how it was supposed to go. Yeah, this is what I meant. This is what I wanted.
I absolutely, that walking back and forth across that line of did I do enough evil? Whoa, that's a little bit too much evil. I'm gonna bring it back. And you get to the end, it's like, no, I didn't do enough evil. I gotta do more evil right at the end here. Yeah, is fantastic. And I think that has bid me to understanding exactly why it was that he was champion to want to return to bring the master character back, knowing that they were gonna have to do it by casting it just right. I think they did.
And then also the, as you mentioned much previous, the, oh, this is too much. All right, I'm out. Peace, bye, good luck.
What do you say? Something like, I'm going to go off of the hillside and watch the demise from a distance or something? Like, yes, it's all going to crumble. I'm going to go grab my fiddle and watch the fire show. Mm-hmm. And I still, to this day, I am never going to understand what a charged vacuum emboitment or a CVE really is.
There was so much like just technobabble in this that at some point I just tapped out. I was like, all right, whatever, they're doing a thing.
Yeah, I totally fried it up. It's like magic. Got it.
Yeah. There you go.
Scientific magic.
Science magic. Mm-hmm. One of these, we'll have to get Professor Brian Cox to break it down for us.
He'll make something up even if it's not real, too.
I would believe it from him. Yeah. Whatever he says, because he'll have charts. I would
accept it as gospel.
So knowing now, well, we can talk about this at this point, knowing that this was, we're watching what everyone was cognizant of at the time were Baker's final scenes, final in-studio shoots, final location shoots, and things like that. Did you feel like you were getting something different from him? Did his portrayal of the Fourth Doctor seem any different than what we had just in some of the previous stories?
Yeah. I mean, it we've mentioned a couple times where it almost felt like Baker was phoning things in. He wasn't as invested in the role or in the portrayal as he previously was or anything like that. This felt more like we were getting the old Fourth Doctor back. You know, it's, he had that kind of emotion and that kind of dedication and stuff. And you could tell, like, he was like, oh no, if I'm going to go out, I'm going to go out like, you know, like I'm supposed to. So it did feel like a proper Baker performance.
I'd agree with that. I say that in all of his scenes, he was larger than every other character. And that's all I've ever really expected from him as the bravado doctor.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. And it fit. I feel like he was there. He also listened, and the scenes where he wasn't in, you didn't feel like he was missed because the writing was good. Mm-hmm. But I do feel like he did his utmost in his job in this 4-episode story.
Right, wanting to go out with the level of gravitas that he feels that he has earned, you know, and that kind of strength. So we wouldn't, I think it'd be foolhardy to try and go around and talk about rewatchability, recommendability, things like that, because it's kind of establishes itself on all counts. But I will ask this, as far as now that we have watched, we collectively have watched every single episode of every story that Tom Baker has filmed in this role, is this particular story what you would consider to be a fitting end to his tenure? You know, is this the way that you would want to see the Fourth Doctor go out? You know, tete-a-tete with the Master, winning but losing, you know, that sort of thing. And the way his regeneration scene sort of handed him a view of all of his, not only his companions, but his adversaries as well.
Yeah, no, I do feel like this kind of, if he was going to have to go out, it needed to be out against the Master or maybe Davros, but I feel like that wouldn't have packed as much punch having him, you know, have to team up with the Master and then being betrayed and, you know, all of the things. And the only thing that I feel, and maybe this is me having been through something similar in New Who, like showing all of the old companions and things like that kind of cheapened the fact that we just got brand new companions that we should be getting to know, but we're focusing on it, you know, similar to the thing they did with having Amy show up at Matt Smith's regeneration. You know, you have to embrace the characters that you have. I think it was great having them show up and having the Doctor be able to see those faces one last time. But I feel like maybe had we not just introduced two new companions, it would have hit a little bit better.
Yeah, that's hard on a new companion to have your first day on the job be when the Doctor regenerates.
Yeah. Right. You become the Band-Aid.
The only positive is that they don't really see that happen until it airs. But I, and you can cut this out if you think this is too silly, but the scarf trip, grab, device drop, kiss fight, middle finger button push, turn, Doctor falls, fight scene, which is how I condense that entire fight scene between them, to me was dramatic and yet also very smooshed into a short portion of time that was sort of telegraphed. So while I feel like the entire three point seven five episodes was good and it led up to that, I do feel like that the sort of fight scene and the reason why he died, yes, it was a long fall, I felt like there was a little bit less drama in that specifically. And I don't know if maybe that's where they felt it fit to put in previous villains, a little bit of emotional scene, and then here's your companions to pull on those heartstrings a bit and then sort of end the life of. So for me, I felt like up to that point, yes, good, but I didn't love that fight scene.
Would it have changed anything if some of their argument and sort of back and forth that they were doing back in the control booth was done during that scuffle so that they'd be sort of talking through the fisticuffs?
Yeah. Okay. I think maybe that would have made it a little better, a little more personal versus like the Doctor ran out and then it was this encapsulated fight. And I get that from the technical aspect of that, it was probably filmed on a windy day and they didn't want to have any dialogue.
Well, yeah, well, that stuff was all done CSO. So they were all out on a rigging on a green screen. So.
Oh, okay. So that makes sense. Like, you don't necessarily want to try to have that technical aspect where you have to insert dialogue into a fight scene like that.
Right.
But, so I felt that. I felt that that was very much like stuck in, make this happen, then he falls, and then here's some drama in between because we're not going to show him falling. Mm. So for me, that was a bit rough.
I can agree with that because having seen this before, I knew what was coming. And as soon as the fight scene started, I instantly like looked down at my phone and was checking text messages and things like that and kind of go, oh, he already fell. Okay, let's pay attention again. Like, investment in watching the fight whatsoever.
Yeah.
I watched it twice so I could just, you know, make sure I caught the whole thing, but...
You were fascinated to know whether or not that was an actual kiss out in the rigging.
It was...
They got real, real close and the camera over the doctor's shoulder and things. And he's either biting his cheek or giving him a peck and saying, you know, you've always been my best friend. Bye, boo!
There was a whisper there that I feel we miss from far away.
Rosebud. Yeah.
But I feel like the... companions and villains flashing before his eyes was a very quick and not irrelevant flash to look what I've given you sort of before the handoff.
Right. Well, the edits specifically were not, I mean, it was just his name being repeated. So it wasn't as if they gave each one of them a special message to send off or anything. It was just him having his name said by his greatest adversaries and then his closest friends in that order. So I get that. So what's your gem from this? I think we all agree that this is a pretty solid story. You know, maybe it's not Baker's best, but it's, you know, it's something at least worthy to see him out. But what is the thing that says that's, you know what, when I look back on Legopolis, this is what I'm going to remember.
I'd have to say Ainley, really. Yeah. Just every bit with the master in Legopolis. You know, from the everything is working according to plan to this is not what I planned. Like, it all just works so well.
I'm mad that I let Jay go first because I was going to say the master.
I will take it a step further and say the quote that envy is the beginning of all true greatness, because I feel like the dynamic between the master and the doctor always goes back to that, is them trying to be better than the other one in every iteration of their battles, etc. It's always them seeing each other as a better or as a friend that they need to continue to be better than.
Right, the frenemy relationship. To,
yes.
The fact that I think in this one, in this story in particular, and I have to agree with all of you, I think the master is really, not to take anything away from Tom Baker, but he comes very, very close to being outshined in this story. But almost any time they'd be together in a scene and they'd go at it, you know, and the word volley is flying, and then one or the other would exit the scene, the one remaining on camera would say something about such a brilliant mind, you know, or what, you know, they were just a genius brain or something. I'm like, y'all love each other. Come on.
Yeah.
Can we get through this?
The one moment that I thought they actually showed that is when the two of them are going through the streets and everything is falling on them. And they're both like brushing off their shoulders like, oh, can't be dirtied by this.
A styrofoam nearly hit me in the eye.
Fast forward a few regenerations and you have 12 and Missy. So, of course, I mean, you still kind of have that.
They're just playing a little cat and mouse right now. They'll get around.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They'll
this is their flirting.
Out. and also hiding in random caves and
why else would you have all those caves?
But how did they find the master's TARDIS when it wasn't even right at the edge of that little hole cave cavern?
Do you not think that he would park that somewhere just conspicuous enough so he could just say it was in front of you the entire time, Doctor? Yes.
Gold pillar right inside this brown cavern of stone.
I'm done. Yeah. So much to love.
This is also the first time I've seen Peter Davison as the Doctor.
This is true. Red letter day. Now, Haley can actually say, I've seen the Fifth Doctor for 4 seconds.
I I have seen him in other episodes, but this is the first time I've seen this regeneration, which is clearly very different from every other regeneration I've seen, which is mostly New Who and a couple
classics, but they even
classics, it's just like replacement of.
Yeah, they change it around each time.
Yeah. So.
Well, next week we're going to be coming back with a reimagining of our Whovian mixology. This time we're going with the bad guys.
We have to. So this is going to be nothing but, 80 proof and higher. what is it? Salt the earth.
Even if it's flavorful, you add extra booze just to make it not taste good.
I took a perfectly normal drink and I floated.
Yeah. I mean, last time we were like, wow, this list would get you messed up. And I feel like this is going to go above and beyond even that much.
I think so too. Well, we'll try to do as we did last time and give some advance notice, because we had some great contributions from listeners both before and after release of the episode with some ideas about what to do with all our iterations of the Doctor. So right now I will say we won't go into the real obscura on villains here.
Unless you have a great one that fits perfectly and you would like to share it with us.
Yeah, if you've got one that is the, whatever the shadow was in Hellbent that every time it touches you, you forget your existence. Awesome. Go with it. But
Jaeger. I mean, what else are you doing for that? Just Jaeger.
She's got a point. I mean,
the drink that sounds like the rest of your evening.
Yay!
Well, we'll get there.
This has been episode 416 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, it's the end, but it has been prepared for.
And this is Kira saying, I'm off to drink in memory of Auntie Nessa.
Oh.
This is Julie saying, I'm collaborating with Haley. Battle stations.
And this is Haley saying, our notes have new formatting, and it's all I've been thinking about the entire podcast.
We'll see you guys next week.
Annalise.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Want to keep the conversation going? You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube, or just send us a good old-fashioned email to feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. You can also give us a phone call at 754-225-5477. That's 754-CALL-GPR, and you may hear your voice on a future episode of the show. Everything's got to end sometime, otherwise nothing would ever get started. Join us next week for a brand new episode.
Jacob Hansen. Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2021. We'll see you next week.
I'm just glad that we got through that entire recording without talking about the brown stain on Adric's pants.
I have it and decided that it wasn't relevant.
It's always relevant, but we save that for the after segment.
Adric brought his own brown pants.
Bring me my brown pants.
And then I have arrow second take? ?